Good afternoon. The campus development summary that we usually give, I'll give again. Everything is progressing well. Hope you get a chance to look outside and see some things that were done. The sod was installed in the west slope along Imperial Drive and around the front entrance sign. So the front door is looking very good. And mulching has been completed around the existing tree bed northeast of the lake. Gives you a little idea of what the gardens will begin to look like once we add more things to them, of course. It is still missing sod on the east side, if our sprinklers will reach it, and rocks and azaleas and rhododendrons and red buds and dogwoods and other things that will go in there, making it really very beautiful. But it gives you a little taste of what some of the other gardens edged in properly and mulched with bushes, small trees, ornamental trees, and flowers will look like. It'll be fun to watch them develop. And I think they finally installed a cover on the well or the spring so we can bury that in that unsightly hole that I've been looking down on for 3 months out of my office will go away, be buried in. We'll never see it unless there's a problem. It'll be a foot or so below the surface. So that's all doing well. We began the foundation of the patio and started pouring cement. That'll be done by Tuesday. Woodwork on the third floor is all done, and the crown molding installed in certain third floor cabinets is done as well. We'll put in the curbs across the street for the mail processing building, and maybe the paving will be a week after. And we will install the west side sidewalk, and we will complete the patio. Perhaps next week we'll be able to walk down and see. We're actually going to create a path, probably a sidewalk, either eventually or I should say soon or eventually, where you'll come down either step and you can turn right or left and you'll be able to walk through an elongated semicircle of Kwanzaa cherries where you will be in a tunnel until you come out the other side. We found some beautiful trees and an absolutely wonderful source of trees has been made available to us this week. Right here in this area, within 30 minutes, just a very fine man, and he caters to elite needs. We'll get them at wholesale prices. He'll even help us install them, cut prices. Wonderful. I mean, this guy does Martha Stewart's home. He does Ralph Lauren's home. And, of course, the noted Judge Judy, you know, and various others like that, and just a grand gentleman to work with. So we're going to see a lot more specimen trees. We're going to design around the lake a walk. On either side of you, there are all kinds of exotic trees in time as we can afford them. We can't do that yet, but we will add things going forward. We're going to put the elm trees on the other side of the road this week, begin irrigation on the north side of the campus, finish sod on the south side of the stream and the east side of the hall of administration after the patio is complete, and then install sod along the south side of Ambassador Drive. I would imagine when you come next week, you will see in many ways things are transformed. If you look out the front door when you leave, you'll see a paint on the grass where we're going to put the new circular 6-foot sidewalk that comes up to a circle around flowers that will be changed seasonally and then continue to the road before we add the other side. That'll be a sidewalk to the mail processing building. I have to think about how we do the new one down to the media center. But that's kind of a part of our plan. Fascinating, some items of news. But first I wanted to talk briefly about the final announcement. Seemed like the appropriate title was simply Final Announcement, and I've referenced this a little bit, but I am going to turn that into a book. It's a pretty long book, be about 90,000 plus words, and many people will want to read the story in 25 chapters. It'll probably be something along the lines, if I've not mentioned this before, maybe I have, you know, the awesome story of the remnant. And it will be a story read and heard in many places in and out of the church, I'm sure. But if you read the announcement last night, I finally had time to edit it a little more this morning, added a few things. You may want to read it again. I had to get a member letter out in the morning and then prepare a sermon and had dinner last night out with some brethren. And so I didn't quite get it as tight as it is now. So you may want to read it again. It is not that long. It's kind of interesting just looking down through these 25 chapters. Some of the announcements were as short as 250 words and others as long as 13,000. I don't know how that'll look in a book, big and little chapters. I'm determined to do it because I know a great many people will want to read it. We received from one of the ministerial assistants who has spent a great deal of time. He lives in Australia now, but he grew up in South Africa, and he spent a lot of time with lions. And in light of the Zechariah 11:3 prophecy about the roaring of the young lions, which I won't explain, I think all of you remember that, know what it's talking about, because their glory is spoiled, if you recall, you will find this letter fascinating. I wanted to read it to you because it speaks to someone who's had tremendous experience with lions. I don't know how many times you'd have in the church some with a lot of experience with lions who could validate what Zechariah 11:3 is talking about. So here we go. I'm going to try to read fast, so it might be a little broken here. I won't have time for the sermon, but I came across interesting thoughts when reading Zechariah 11:3, where God talks about a voice of the roaring of young lions. As you may know already, my upbringing in Africa allowed me to be exposed to many of its wild animals. Lions were one of them. I loved to study the animals in our area, and I still have a special interest for the wildlife in Africa. My father had his own citrus farm, but he also had a shareholding in a game farm close by. We had quite a few lions on the farm, and I enjoyed spending lots of time there. I read many books about lions and watched countless documentaries about them. I've watched them kill prey, fight, charge, eat, mate, and roar many times in the wild. I've played with young lions too. Sounds millennial, but don't try it yet. He knew what he was doing. The farm manager on the game farm had a young male lion as a pet for a while. I'm pretty sure that I have a reasonable understanding about lions in the wild, how the pride interact with each other, the role of male lions, etc. You may know that lions are the only cat species that live in a group or a pride, as we call it. From what I've seen, when it comes to animals, God uses the word lion or lions second only to lamb in the Bible. I think one of the reasons are because lions are not only very beautiful, big, strong, and courageous, but they live in an extremely complex family structure, male on top, then females, and then finally cubs. Back to the scripture. When a group of young lions roar, as described in Zechariah 11:3, it usually happens when they have been kicked out of their pride. God is referring to young lions that are roaming free in the wild as they should. Young lions in a zoo or in captivity will roar too, but that's only because they are not in their normal environment. They are completely lost and out of place. Fascinating. Those poor zoo lions and all other animals in a zoo have lost most of their natural instinct. As you know, by putting wild animals in a zoo, it destroys the instinct that God has put in them to survive. Zechariah 11:3 is also referring to male lions. It has to be. I will explain. When a group of young lions roar, as described here, 99.99% of the time, it only happens when young male lions are kicked out of their pride by the pride male. In other words, it's an action that came against them if they're a young lion. Now, that's fascinating. They are always kicked out when they reach approximately 18 to 24 months old. Then they roar for days before they will quiet down because they realize they only attract other males, which will kill them. This is what happened to the lion our game farm manager had as a pet I mentioned earlier. One can bank on it. Young lions very, very seldom roar by themselves while they are in a pride. Frankly, I've never seen it or heard of young females or young males roaring by themselves while with the dominant male. When they reach 12 to 18 months, they will start to roar with the females, but they will hardly ever roar alone while in the pride. The pride male will not tolerate it. Sometimes young lions get separated from their pride, but it usually takes only one or two loud roars to establish where their pride is, then followed by a few smaller grunts as they get closer to the pride. Young males always roar when they're kicked out. It's like they're calling their parents and cannot understand why their pride has turned against them. They are lost, and they want to be back in the comfort of their pride. Now, you're thinking of the nation of Israel as you read this, and you'll see some fascinating things. Under their mother and father's protection. However, the pride male will kill them if they don't leave. It's pretty basic knowledge for anyone who's worked with lions in the wild. The females will sometimes join the male to chase the young males out of the pride. The young females, however, stay in the pride. Things can get brutal, and pride males have killed their own offspring if they fail to leave. The young males are then homeless with no support structure around them. In fact, the support they knew all their life has literally overnight and suddenly become their worst enemy. This is not a gradual process that takes weeks. The pride male often turns on these young males out of nowhere. It nearly always happens in one day. It's all instinct. Something gets into that big male lion, and I think of the United States, that's me adding this, and filled with fury, he explodes against the young males who only laid next to him the day before. I've seen this happen on our farm, and it's been documented in the wild many times. It happens in one day as a big surprise to the young males. On a human level, and with our understanding, one cannot help but think of the young males, Israel, how they will feel betrayed by their closest allies. We had a whole pride, one big male and five females in a reasonable enclosure, 150 acres, on a bigger game farm of 20,000 acres. I think this is interesting. I'm just going to continue reading. It's not that much longer, but we can learn. We had a few free-roaming lions on the farm as well, but they were a little elusive. The whole pride was captured in Zimbabwe on a big reserve where they roamed free and was relocated to this 150-acre enclosure on the farm so tourists could be guaranteed to see lions when they visit the reserve. This is wrong, too. It was all about money. This was in 1997. We called the male Mugabe. Well, guess why? Zimbabwe. After the country's president, how ironic that Robert Mugabe kicked out most of the white farmers a few years later. Anyway, the pride's natural family structure was in place and going well. Two females gave birth to cubs approximately 12 months later, and we watched the cubs grow up. It was when the two young males were roughly 18 months old that the pride male erupted against them. Mugabe was a huge lion, weighed over 500 pounds, and his face was scarred by all the previous battles. A side note. A male brought up in captivity seldom, if ever, has a scarred face. The two young males weighed merely 300 pounds. They had no chance. We anticipated this, of course, but had to scramble to relocate the young males immediately to get them out of the big male's reach. Mugabe turned on them a little sooner than expected. It's interesting. Those young males roared nearly nonstop every night for weeks when they were taken out of the pride. It was the first time they roared by themselves. If we did not intervene and relocate the two young males, a big male would have certainly killed them. Before this, while they were under the male's submission, they would not roar by themselves. They will only join the chorus when the females roar. I watched them do this many times. I was often so close to them when they roared that I could smell their breath. It's quite an experience. Did he really need to say that? Anyway, I'm not sure how fast it bends. Of course, the prophecy will be broken, but according to what we already know, it will happen fast, like grace. I thought what I have experienced in the wild of lions fits interestingly and well into the prophecy. It is quite fascinating. I hope you can see some correlation. This is just personal speculation, but I will not be surprised if it will be America who shuns Israel. It will be America who chases Israel away, and Israel will roar to find a new friendship. That is already happening, as Mr. Pack mentioned. I doubt if it could ever have happened under a Republican administration, as was referenced at the conference. I will not be surprised if there will be a short, open, ugly dispute on the world scene between the Obama administration and Israel. In the fulfillment of that prophecy. Thought you would find that interesting. A little bit of news. On Elul 1, there is going to be a very large demonstration just below the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. For the first time ever, the Muslims, for the second half of Ramadan, are closing the Temple Mount, and it's caused an uproar. No pun intended with what I just read, but I mean a real uproar in Israel. And it's interesting that they are picking Elul 1. To protest something that's never happened before. The Jews and Christians and all other non-Muslims are forbidden in the last 2 weeks to go up to the Mount. One wonders about the timing and, again, how America will respond to such turbulence in the world. Read an article this morning about the Jerusalem Day, or Al-Quds Day, as they call it in Iran, where they're protesting. Been doing it since the revolution in 79. I think this is the 35th year they've done it. But they, of course, want Muslims, are trying to rally Muslims all over the world to liberate Jerusalem from the Jews. So there's more and more pressure going on. And Assad is doing better as well in Syria, which is potentially good or potentially very bad news for Israel. We'll just have to see how that works. A couple other things. One is from a pastor in southeastern Ohio. On the news front, an outlet recently reported that researchers from the Mayo Clinic, I want you to just think of the pale horse of Revelation 6, brethren, and back to what he said, found that 70% of all American citizens are on some kind of prescription medication. That's over two-thirds. The most common drugs prescribed were antibiotic, antidepressants, and painkillers. Even more concerning is the fact that half of the nation's people, and by the way, think Obamacare, and why they've said the cost, oh, by the way, is not $900 billion, but $2.8 trillion will be the cost of Obamacare over the long haul. Even more concerning is the fact that half of the nation's people are on two drugs, and a staggering one-fifth of all American citizens use more than five medications or more types of medication prescribed by their doctor. The same article indicated that according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the amount of people using at least one of these drugs, I think the three above, has risen 50% from 2007 to 2010. By the way, those statistics are 3 years old. What is it today? As more and more people are unhappy and they want to pop a pill. I just read, you won't believe this, but there is actually a pill, and maybe I mentioned it last week, there is actually a pill almost ready to go that allows you to pop it in lieu of exercise. The pill will exercise for you. They say, no, that cannot be. But if you study where science is going, it will trigger certain chemicals and hormones in the body and the reaction as though you're on a treadmill, jogging, walking, or in some way working out, swimming. Astonishing. People want a pill for everything. In 2009 alone, $250 billion was spent nationally on prescription drugs. What you're talking about are hundreds of millions of immune systems that are not ready for what is coming. I think you all understand the meaning. Finally, a conservative prime minister in Britain said this week, "I want to export gay marriage all around the world." That's the title of the article. Now, this is a conservative PM. And he spoke of his pride, his own, I guess, gay pride in that sense, at legalizing same-sex marriage. Just a year after explicitly giving a personal guarantee to do it by 2015, to a reception for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual community at 10 Downing Street. He told guests at the same reception 1 year on that Britain was now, quote, the best place in the world to be gay, lesbian, or transgender. Astonishing. That we have reached this, he says, is a great achievement. That's not my measure. That is an internationally recognized measure. But there's still a lot more work to be done. And I want to export same-sex marriage around the world so other countries could follow suit. We could just turn right off of the subject I want to cover and discuss all that God says about the nation of Ephraim and how they are sick from head to toe to think that the people of Israel, who have the Bible, who once struck a special covenant with God, that they would obey Him, are now the ones taking to the nations of the world the very standard they were supposed to stand against as a model for all nations. It is truly an obscenity and an abomination for the ages, but exactly what Christ said before He would come. As it was in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, of course, he said, as in Noah's day too, Sodom and Gomorrah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. But people would be fooled because they'll be eating and drinking and planting and reaping, he said, building and giving and taking in marriage and all the things he said. Things would look better than they are, but to look for certain things that, of course, we in God's church are watching for because Christ said to do that. All right, now the subject. I've planned for about a month and a half, maybe a little more, to give a sermon that begins with this statement. It's not from the Bible, but it certainly, in a certain way, could be. It's in harmony with the Bible, and most all of you have heard it. Here it is. There, but for the grace of God, go I. Now, the person who uttered that was looking at a beggar on the street and talking about how, were it not for God's grace, he could be that person. It's true. There are 101 million people in America. You see three Americans, one of them is receiving food assistance. The greatest nation in the history of the world, greatest nation on earth, but in the history of the world now has a full one-third of its people on food assistance. And you stop and realize, if you're not receiving it, you could say, there but for the grace of God go I. You see someone who is a Buddhist, trapped in rank idolatry, born into it, having no idea that it is pure superstition, a religion based upon fiction after fiction, and you could say, there but for the grace of God go I. The same would be true of a Taoist, a Shintoist, a Hindu, or a Muslim. You're born a little Muslim child, and you are taught to hate, and if possible, to exterminate non-believers, unbelievers, infidels. The Bible talks about infidels. Well, so do the Muslims. Infidel just means a non-believer. But non-believer of what? Not the infidel that God has in mind, but if you're an infidel according to what the Muslim religion, the Quran, teaches. And they take a much grimmer view than any other religion does toward non-believers. And you think, what did a child do to be born to a Muslim? Nothing. What is a child? How is a child responsible if it's born of fornication versus born to the King of England in marriage? The child did nothing. But after a certain fashion, even though we're not talking about the grace of God in the Christian sense, such people could utter there, pointing to places other than where they are, but for the grace of God, go I. Even in the broadest sense, if you think of Christianity as the world does, 2.2 billion Christians, out of 7.1 billion people on earth, making 4.9 billion people not even professing to be Christians, and we know the vast majority of the 2.2 billion who do are not Christians. They don't do a single thing God says, not one, and so we understand that. But for the moment, you've got almost 5 billion people who don't even know there is a thing called the grace of God, who couldn't even utter that sentence when looking at somebody in worse condition. Christians theoretically have heard of the grace of God, Christians of every stripe, flavor, color, texture, and size, you understand what I mean, and they could say it. But people technically, as I've said, who are not Christians, but merely better stationed in life, if they thought this way, might say it. Now, that becomes an introduction to something. The world speaks endlessly of God's love and mercy. The churches of the world, and I've talked about this before, mercy is directly connected to grace. Some people think grace is a prayer. Who's going to say grace? Grace is not a prayer. That's one of the dumbest statements of all time. Who's going to say mercy? Well, somebody around the room ought to just say, oh, I'll say it. Okay, mercy. Who's going to say grace? Anyway, I'll do it. Okay, grace or forgiveness. That's what grace means. Grace means unmerited pardon. It's not prayer. That shows you how little hundreds of millions of people understand about grace. They don't understand the difference as Christians between prayer and mercy. They might be connected insofar as you would pray for mercy, but they are not the same thing. That should be obvious. And it is to us, but it's not in the world. But it becomes a lead-in to the world speaks endlessly of God's love. They have no idea what it is, that love is the fulfilling of the law. And that it says that in two places, Romans and 1 John 5:1-3. Love is the keeping of the commandments. Well, the world that talks about love doesn't believe the commandments are in effect, that they're done away. So even though they talk about love all the time, and we're going to see mercy all the time in the churches of the world, the two things they talk about, they know nothing about. They know how to talk about it. They don't know what it is. Now, I understand why they talk about love and mercy. Because if they talked about any kind of requirements by God, people would get up, walk down the street, and as I've explained in the past, put their money in some other minister's offering plate. It's about the cash. It's about money. Love plays well. It's feel-good religion. God loves me. God forgives me. It's true. God loves people. God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son. You know the rest of John 3:16. And there's hundreds of verses in the Bible about God's mercy. Those are biblical subjects, and they must be understood from a biblical foundation. But in the world, they talk about them, and they cheapen these great truths, and this is not a sermon about love, we're going to talk about mercy. They cheapen these great principles and reduce them to a way to keep people coming to church who otherwise would leave if you tell them they have to change anything about their life. Massage me, soothe me, coo at me. Tell me how God feels about me, but don't you tell me to change anything, because I can go find hundreds and thousands and frankly millions of ministers who would tell me to come just as I am, as the song goes. And most people see Christianity as a come as you are party. And not only come as you are, but stay as you are, and woe to the minister. He is the living, breathing, walking unemployed if he starts getting into anything in these 750,000 words that people ought to actually do to be a Christian. So when we talk about love, we shouldn't be embarrassed to use the word, because Protestants cheapen it. I listen to people talk about what the Lord has done for them. I hear it all the time. But Lord means master. And Christians in the world do not look at or act as though they believe Christ is their master in any way. That what he says they ought to do. Furthermore, they don't even read what he says to do. And most of them can't say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the right order. And half of them can't say them in any order. They can't think of the four books of the Bible in which it says twice in Matthew and Luke, they're to live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Well, they don't live by any of the words that proceed from the mouth of God, because they don't even know where their Bible is. It's wherever they put it down a year ago when they moved it out of the way to grab something near it. We understand all of that. But I want to just say the subject of mercy, which could be similarly called forgiveness or pardoning, and grace are biblical. They are biblical. And Christians ought to understand them. They are central to all things Christian. We know that the prophecy opposite bands that we talked about a moment ago regarding lions is grace. It's interesting. It's mistranslated, and we've explained that from the Hebrew, calls it beauty. But it's grace. That Hebrew word could be translated beauty or pleasantness or various other related terms, but it means grace, because that summarizes the New Testament covenant that God is talking about. It's a prophecy about grace. Now, it's interesting, and we've not focused on this as we should, but I'll throw you an interesting thought. It's kind of an aside, but it's related. There are two sides of the coming reunion of God's people related to grace. There are those, of course, we have focused most on, who are going to lose God's grace. But the better part of the story, the wonderful part of the story, and the story that naturally in the explaining of that prophecy got a short shrift, is the fact that great numbers are going to retain it. Which kind of brings to mind an interesting thought. God snaps his staff called grace. Well, he must have another one. I don't know how many he has, but he has to have another one, because for many he does not snap the staff, and the staff has to continue to exist. He must have two staffs called grace. Yeah, I understand it's symbolic. I don't think God in the third heaven is snapping a stave or a staff called grace. Although, who knows, maybe he does. In any event, for all of you, we would say, every one of us would say, we hope he doesn't snap it regarding us. We understand all the verses that show he could, and that's a decision that we will control. We will help God, and many will lead God to make one way or another. Turn over to Romans 11. A year ago, this month, I learned that God has a remnant, and it is a New Testament remnant. We all understand there's an Old Testament remnant, but in Romans chapter 11, I want to read something to you. Maybe I should have noticed this a year ago. I didn't. I noticed it a week or two ago, a couple weeks maybe. But I want to show you something. We read this last August, and we learned that God has a remnant of people. And it was only later, of course, that we began to learn how he was going to restore them to his church, or when, what was involved. But first, God had to notify us that he had a remnant. I did not know that. I struggled for many, many, many years. Basically about 19 years before that, trying to figure out where are all the people who said they would never leave what they have now, in part or whole, left. Where are they? And there were many, many things that I tried to do as a shepherd, trained under Mr. Armstrong, to wake people up. I learned later, of course, why none of it worked. It was not God's purpose, and I've only learned in the last year what God's purpose was, as we came to understand this prophecy called grace. But this is a series of verses we read a year ago, and by now I'm sure if you've been in the church any length of time, you've heard that sermon series. It was seven sermons. I say then, has God cast away his people? Now, that's interesting too, because you find the term cast off in Psalm 44. But Romans 11:1 asks the question. And this is, of course, for us at the end of the age. Paul thought he lived at the time Christ returned. We all know that prophecy, or those scriptures. And then he had to learn, finally, no, I don't live at the time Christ will return. I'm going to die. And Christ never told even the original apostles how long it would be before he returned. Every single one of them wrote their epistles and various instructions as though Christ would return in their lifetime. Meaning in the first century, not the 21st century. And they were with him 3.5 years, and he would not tell them when he was going to return. But he preached and talked with such an urgency that they all just assumed, he's not saying it, but we know it's going to be in our lifetime. Slowly, Paul and Peter and others, John later, had to come to realize, no, it's beyond our lifetime. But they lived with a certain urgency, and that was good, and they wrote in ways that eventually would apply to a final generation on planet Earth who should live with, now that these great prophecies are upon us, the urgency that the apostles lived with, but 20 full centuries too early. Has God cast away his people? God forbid. For I am also an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Now, Romans 8 explained who God foreknew. That could be talking about ancient Israel. Let's follow. This is interesting. This is talking about physical Israel or spiritual Israel. I wondered, and we've gone through this, but I want to show you something else. Know you not what the scripture says of Elijah? How he makes intercession to God against Israel, saying, this story is in 1 Kings 19, fascinating. Lord, they have killed your prophets and digged down your altars. They dug them down and destroyed them. And I am left alone and they seek my life. What's interesting, I want to stop for a moment and tell you, if you go back and read 1 Kings 19, recognizing that Paul, when he gets into the subject of the remnant in the next two verses, that God has reserved a New Testament remnant, Paul came off of 1 Kings 19. There's more in 1 Kings 19 than meets the eye. There was what I call the Earth, Wind, and Fire concert. I referenced it last week, where God only afterwards spoke to Elijah in a still small voice. There were tremendous, powerful miracles. And then God spoke to Elijah, said exactly the same thing he'd said before, but the second time, Elijah was listening. And he was a great servant of God. So then you come down to three swords that were involved. I'm not going to get into this, but they're fascinating. Elijah was supposed to go anoint a Gentile king, an Israelite king, and even Elisha, who would be his replacement. 8 chapters later, Elisha was taken up into the first heaven and disappeared. People think he went to heaven. We know he didn't, but he went up into the first heaven. And that's an interesting point. And there was a lot there in 1 Kings 19 that I've been studying the last couple of weeks as to why, in light of 1 Corinthians 10:11 and Romans 15:4, that the Old Testament accounts are written for our learning and our admonition and our comfort and hope, that when specifically an account, go have fun studying it, when specifically an account is cited in the New Testament and in the context of the coming remnant, how much more ought you go home and study 1 Kings 19? I could bring out some things that are so fascinating, but that's not what my sermon's about. Sorry, don't have time. We're going to go on to something else. But you know me, I do that. I throw those things out and then move on. But I will soon enough. But what says the answer of God to him? I have reserved to myself 7,000. What's interesting, and I'll throw this part in. What's interesting is if you go back and read it in 1 Kings, it is mistranslated. There weren't 7,000 people huddled somewhere who have not bowed the knee to Baal. The reason Elijah didn't know about them is they were scattered through a larger Israelite nation and they had not yet been winnowed out into a group of 7,000 as a remnant. They were still blurred into Israel, and it would take the coming of three specific prophesied swords after the lifetime of Elijah to find out who those 7,000 were. I just gave you a few additional keys there as to the appearance of the 7,000. They would come after those swords played out, and the swords all played out beyond Elijah's lifetime. Elijah had no chance whatsoever to relate to come to know who the remnant was. That ought to be interesting just in itself when we think of how Mr. Armstrong was the final Elijah. He knew about Haggai, he knew about Zechariah, but he had no idea who that remnant was. It says, for I have reserved, there in Kings, it's not correct. It's I will reserve. And you can prove it by the context. Just go read it. Because it followed a prophecy that God said, I shall do this, and as a result, I will do the other. I will reserve these people. Back to where we were. I don't want you to get too far afield. That's not my subject. But let's read verse 4 again. But what says the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men, its people, who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then, after this fashion, at this present time, also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. So this is a remnant involving grace. Now, I wasn't aware a year ago of the meaning of the prophecy called grace, but it makes perfect sense that this remnant of 7,000, if that indeed is the number, or if it's a type of some other number, we don't know that, but we'll learn it soon enough, that this is a group that was elected and they continue to receive grace, while for others that staff is snapped. Well, that's fascinating. Now remember, the present time that Paul thought about in his age, in his time, he learned later and had to tell the Corinthians and he told the Thessalonians, I had it wrong. And this is going to be beyond my lifetime. But he wrote Romans at the same time he wrote 1 Corinthians and 1 Thessalonians before he understood that he was not going to be alive and remain at the time of Christ's return. He was not going to be resurrected out right out of the physical lifetime, as many of us, of course, will expect to experience. That was not going to happen to him. So we now know it applies to us. And one of the fascinating things is if Paul had referenced Haggai as the source of the remnant, it might have opened that prophecy too soon, and it would have been understood too soon. But secondarily, we would never have known that 1 Kings 19 had an application. God knew he would show us the meaning of Haggai at the right time, meaning soon enough. But we would never have known that what Elijah experienced or heard about and was experienced later by Elisha, would never have known that that was a parallel, an account we ought to study for our learning, admonition, comfort, and hope. And that this is an election of grace. Now, turn over to Romans 9 for a moment. Verse 27, Isaiah also cries concerning Israel. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. That's a physical remnant of Israel. That's a physical remnant of Israel. It is not talking about spiritual Israel. But then you get to chapter 11, and here's this spiritual remnant that is according to grace. And if by grace, then it is no more of works. That's interesting. What does that mean? Otherwise, grace is no more grace. Grace means unmerited pardon. You can't do anything to qualify for forgiveness. We can come and say, God, I have lived a virtuous life. I'm just a generally wonderful person or a quality person. I've done this, that, or the other set of works. You owe me salvation. Well, then it wouldn't be an unmerited pardon. It wouldn't be forgiveness. It wouldn't be just a free gift. That's what grace means. And that includes forgiveness of our past. Technically, mercy and forgiveness are elements of grace, not an exact equation. Grace is something that transcends mercy and forgiveness and involves all that God does to us. In fact, we're going to read a verse in a moment that shows you can grow in grace. How do you grow in grace? You either have it or you don't, right? No, wrong. The Bible says you grow in it. Now, before we explain how the works fit in, we'll qualify that. Let's turn over to Jeremiah 50 and verse 20. I want to be sure, brethren, all of us are ready for what God is about to do. I want us to all understand that we have a certain role. Now, speaking of Israel, in verse 19, God talks about the days that he will bring Israel back. Verse 19, Jeremiah 50:5. Verse 19, I will bring Israel again to his habitation. When Christ returns, he will do that. He sets up his government out of Jerusalem. He shall feed on Carmel and Bashan. I've been to all those places, and Gilead. There are areas around north, south, and east of Jerusalem. In those days and in that time, says the Lord, the iniquity of Israel shall be sought for, and there shall be none. And the sins of Judah, and they shall not be found. Today, the sins of Israel and Judah, just think of David Cameron, and just think of the nation of Israel that have rejected Jesus Christ. Well, he certainly hasn't covered their sins or paid for or pardoned their sins. So those sins are all over the nations of Western Europe. The United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Holland, France, the Scandinavian countries, the descendants of Israel, and of course the Middle Eastern nation of Judah that the world calls Israel, and they call themselves that. Their sins are everywhere, but there is coming a time when they won't be. God has a remnant that's going to come on through, and he says, for I will pardon them whom I reserve. Now, I was talking about ancient Israel and the remnant that comes through the horrors of the next few years. But God has an election, according to grace, that involves a few that come through now. But let's read Isaiah 55. Go back to near the end of Isaiah. Does God give mercy to anybody? All you have to do is ask for it. You listen to these phony Protestant preachers. Ask people to just come up and give their heart to the Lord, and they'll receive forgiveness and they can be baptized in an utter sham that insults God. It means Christ died for them, but they don't have to change. They don't have to do anything about what caused him to have to die. This innocent God being who had lived for all eternity had to die for people who simply had to say, I accept your sacrifice, and I'm going to turn right around and continue to do the things that got you crucified. But you come down to, what does God say? That's what men say. Men are not as smart in religion, the ministers of this world, as law enforcement and the courts of America. They know when people are pardoned for crimes they have committed, the assumption is they'll leave the prison or jail, or in some cases a death penalty, and they won't do what got them the sentence or the punishment. They've been pardoned. Men cut off from God know that in civil societies, when someone is pardoned, the assumption is automatic that you won't go out and do the same thing again. The vast majority of Christendom is not nearly that smart. They're stupid. They think God is not as smart as human courts. He will forgive you and allow you to continue to do the exact same things. Thumb your nose in his face. Trample his law. Reject his word. Why, better yet, don't even pick it up and read it. You sure don't have to worry about copying it if you're smart enough to know never to pick it up. Ministers don't say that, but they should. They should just be honest. But God says this, let the wicked forsake his way. Isaiah 55:7. Let's read verse 6. Seek you the Lord while he may be found. Call you upon him while he is near. Time is running out in this age. A lot of people who will soon wish they had sought God when they could, but the sand is falling through the hourglass. Well, it says, while he may be found. That suggests, you know, the verse in the end of Hosea 5, there is coming a point where God is closing the curtain. And then horrible prophecies have to be fulfilled before he opens the curtain again and gives mankind 1,000 years of peace under Christ and the saints. So most of the sand has fallen through God's great 6,000-year hourglass. And while he is near, let the wicked forsake his way. Well, wait a minute. Don't you just profess Jesus and call for mercy and grace? And the unrighteous man his thoughts. And let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy on him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. But you have to change your life. Ministers don't say that. They'll throw a little stab at it once in a while. Throw in a few principles. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither your ways my way, says the Lord. Remember the sermons I gave a couple months ago on that subject? In other words, the setup is you have got to change your thoughts and change your ways. Turn from your wicked way. And the rest of those verses we understand. Now Ephesians 2 and back to grace and works. We read in Romans that it's by grace and not works. Do works play no role? Is there any other verse where we might read God adds to Romans 11 so that people can't just snatch one verse out of the Bible and run away and say, I have no responsibility for works. We've already just read Isaiah 55, so we know that we have to turn from our wicked way for God to show mercy and to pardon us. But let's look at Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 8. For by grace are you saved through faith. Now, it's so pure from works as far as salvation, let's understand. And even the faith, that, the faith, not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. Because if we worked up faith, and we, working up faith, now I have faith, you owe me grace. Well, that was a work. So God even has to give us the gift of faith to believe that Christ is our Savior, died for us. Or you had to come up with at least one work, that's human faith, that you kind of ginned up and funked up and made yourself furrow your brow and clench your teeth and come up with faith, which isn't how you come up with faith anyway. We all know that. Not of works, lest any man should boast. I'm receiving salvation because I'm worthy of it. I'm virtuous. I'm a great man or woman, you see, and I've done wonderful things. No, but most theologians, you've heard this, I'm sure, many times, most theologians stop reading there. They dare not read verse 10. Because if they do, it blows their Sunday sermons, and the offering plates will shrink right quick along with their audience. For we are His workmanship. Oh, there are good works involved, but God does them through us, created in Christ Jesus unto good works. The very next verse says, you had better be bringing works, but they are Christ in you. If they're your own works, then all of a sudden you're earning salvation, which is what people accuse us of, because we just won't reach down and snip Ephesians 2 and verse 10 and Isaiah 55 and others out of the Bible. Like Martin Luther said, I don't like the book of James because it says faith without works is dead. And he called it an epistle of straw because it didn't fit his theology. He didn't care what God's theology was. And 100 million people follow Martin Luther, who rejected one of the books of the Bible. It was written by Christ's brother. That's kind of interesting. Which God has before ordained that we should walk in them. You look up ordained, it's appointed, commanded that we do certain works. So yes, there is grace. And it's not our works that gets us grace. So we receive salvation as a free gift, but it comes with, as been explained, qualifiers. There are qualifiers. You can't be a lying, whoremongering, thieving idolater. You can't do any of those things. Those are qualifiers. I've often used this example. It's the best I've ever been able to think of. And that is, if you have a mega wealthy father and he sends his son off to school. And he says, now, son, at the end of graduation, I'm going to give you $1 million after 4 years. But number one, you can't get drunk. Number two, you have to have a B average. Number three, you can't get any girls pregnant. Those are the three rules. Then you get $1 million. So the guy graduates. The son comes to his dad. And the dad gives him $1 million. Did he earn $1 million? Of course not. He merely did what any young man going to college ought to do, but virtually none do today, by the way. Everybody should do that. But if he hadn't done those qualifiers, would he have gotten $1 million? The answer is no. And so it is with salvation. There are qualifiers. There are disqualifiers. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew 5. The Bible is filled with the subject of mercy. We're going to move faster through some verses now. Matthew 5. The beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Almost right out of the gate, Christ comes to the subject of mercy. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit. There's the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, not heaven. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. That's interesting. Wait a minute, I thought you get mercy no matter what you do. Well, one of the qualifiers for even getting mercy is you have to be merciful. The implication is, if you're not merciful, you will not obtain mercy. They will. In other words, if you're not, others won't. You won't. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. You see, and so forth. There are qualifiers. Each time you do something, then you get something in return. But it all starts with the free gift of salvation. Chapter 6, look at this. It's often called the Lord's Prayer, but it's supposed to be our prayer. Because after this manner, therefore, pray you, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done, in earth as it is in heaven. Wow, that's a high standard. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. All right, so there again, forgiveness, a giant, the biggest element of grace, is tied directly to how we forgive others. It's another way of saying what he said one chapter before in the very same sermon. Blessed are the merciful, for they, not anybody else, they shall obtain mercy. So mercy has a qualifier. Here it is again. So does forgiveness. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. So does a person who is unforgiving of people who are debtors can expect that God will not forgive such a person his debts to God. Different subject, the debts to God. It's kind of interesting. The world hears about love and mercy all the time, but you don't see much mercy out there in the world. I'm not suggesting that banks would be merciful to all of us and forgive us our mortgages. It's a great idea. It sounds good. Let me think about it some more. But anyway, I'm kidding. It's not being applied. And well, none of the Sermon on the Mount is being applied. I find amazing, and this is part of the problem, people hear the word mercy. If there's one thing you don't see between people, whether it's chapter 5 and mercy or chapter 6 and forgiving one another, is that. You don't see that. A few here and there will say, I forgive you. But like Romans 12 and verse 8, he says, he who forgives, let him do it with cheerfulness. Oh, I forgive you. All right, we'll start over. You might see that a little bit out there. Now, the world is filled with a lot of tolerance, politically correct. If somebody wants to be LGBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, or anything else they want to be, we need to be tolerant. It has nothing to do with forgiveness. So people think they're wonderfully understanding and compassionate and forgiving of people because they're tolerant of outright vile sin. That's different. The world is plenty tolerant. Now, they're not tolerant of us because we appear to them to be intolerant. So the world's tolerant of everything but intolerance. They'll tolerate anything. In Germany, you can have sex with animals. It's legal. You can go out and sleep with your dog. Now, if you don't have tolerance toward Germans, and there are many nations of the world where people can sleep and have sex with their horses and sheep, anything. That's a fact. That's the planet we live on. And it's growing worse. And we're supposed to tolerate it. But ironically, that same world, if we don't want to tolerate it because God doesn't, they won't tolerate us. That tolerance is as thin as a sheet of paper. So I'm speaking of forgiving other people, what they do to you, not tolerating them the way the world does. An absolute phony, politically correct nonsense. The Pope came out. 1.2 billion people think he represents God when he says nothing that's in the scripture. I'm not trying to bash the Pope. Basically send a message, you can be a gay priest, just don't practice. And say, I don't want to judge them. I'm just trying to bash the Pope. There is a worldwide movement now to go straight to and put everybody with residence in Sodom and Gomorrah. That is wrong. Eventually, there'll be one organization speaking into a howling gale force, or maybe I should say Category 5 hurricane, that is wrong. For the few remaining years, we are permitted to do that before the night comes when no man can work and we cannot do God's work. Of course the Pope had to say that, because he would look intolerant if he didn't. And when 20% of the priests in the Vatican are openly gay, what are you going to do? Get rid of the 20%? No. You throw the Bible out the window and say something idiotic like, to whom am I to judge them? Wait a minute. Judging means condemn as unable to be redeemed by God and worthy of eternal death in the lake of fire. That's judging. The world uses the term, I don't want to judge you, as a way of practicing tolerance toward every vile conduct under the sun. Again, that's not mercy. That's tolerance. And it's often under the mantra, I don't want to judge you, I'm not your judge. Now, if you see somebody having sex with a donkey, I'm sorry, that's sin. It's happening. You see homosexuality, you see somebody trying to flip their sex, you see somebody tell a lie, commit adultery, fornicate, blaspheme God, steal tithes, reject His law, those are sin. That it's not judging them. You're not saying, because you did that, I've decided you're worthy of eternal punishment. That's judging them. I've decided God can't work with you anymore. You are ruined. That's judging them. You know, if an employer is trying to fill a position and somebody comes in and applies for the job and he says, you don't meet the standards that we're looking for, has he judged him? No, he's just made an observation about the person's qualifications. But in this world, that's practically judging people. That's why the Pope threw a bone to a lot of radical, far-left nuns who want to have mouths the size of Utah. They want a voice in the church. He wouldn't dare go against the feminist spirit, and that's why I came out a week ago and said, we need a new theology of women. What else was he going to say? Or he'd have a lot of really angry women who he needs to tell to sit down and shut up. But he won't, because that wouldn't play. They just get louder and more strident. And so he has to be more and more and more and more inclusive. Well, not just the Pope. The governments of men do, as the whole world moves left. They move more and more left and left and left and left. You have to tolerate. And anybody who stands up against right and wrong, you know, the difference, wrong, stands out like a sore thumb. Which means God stands out like a sore thumb. But he does give mercy. He does give his grace. And that's what he says. A lot of people are coming back. And we're going to have to be very careful that we do not condemn them. Because for a little while they may not look like us, act like us, or talk like us, because they've been in a different place. And we better have a there but for the grace of God go I. And there but for the grace of God was I, until God brought me here earlier. And how dare me interfere with God's election of grace? Every Christian has won an election. You don't have to run for office to win the greatest election you could ever participate in, you could ever win. You not only were elected, you're a permanent winner. You have a life term, not 2 years or 4 years as a president, two as a congressman, or six as a senator. It's a life term, as long as you are faithful. You have an election of grace, a selection. It can be both. 2 Peter 3 and verse 18, 2 Peter 3:18 says, grow in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now often that verse, 2 Peter 3:18, the second half of it, we're to grow in knowledge, but we forget that it says grow in grace. Look at that. You can store up the mercy of God. I've used the analogy, it's the best one I can think of. It's like insurance when you're driving a car. If you've never had an accident, you can have several accidents before you lose coverage. Each time you have an accident, you thin the amount of time where you will receive coverage. You have a second accident, your rates can begin to go up. Then the third accident, and pretty soon you can start being in trouble, and then you're blackballed by the insurance companies, and you don't have coverage. You had too many infractions, too many driving sins, if you will, too many accidents. And you can lose coverage. A Christian is the same if he just keeps on sinning. Just keeps on sinning. Then he not only won't grow in grace, he will diminish in the grace he has, and eventually he will lose coverage. But the flip side of that is you can grow in grace. The more you serve God, the more you try to please him, and the longer you do it, and the more you overcome, you grow and you overcome, the more you sit in God's grace. And we might, I'm using an analogy, please understand, and the lower your rates are. And of course, all our rates are free. I'll speak personally for a moment, if I can, and then it applies to all of us. Here come thousands of people, and I've prayed for a balance, probably the hardest challenge of my life, but these thousands are coming, and I remember the liberal years. I was in the ministry in the early 1970s, and I saw the liberal years, and I was not liberal, and I got in hot water with men who were. That story's told in my biography, but those go back to 1973 when the heat got the hottest 40 years ago, and I was a young minister. But I remember and was closest to Mr. Armstrong during the period of time that he was putting the church back on track from the liberal years, which were basically 1972 to the middle of 78. And it took him about 3.5 years to do it. And I want you to think about something. There's a balance. Mr. Armstrong, in an age that was 35 years ago, when conditions on planet Earth were a lot better than they are today, beginning in May 1978, in the Philadelphian Age of the Church, number two. Number three, as Herbert W. Armstrong, not me, needed number four, 3.5 years to pull people back from number five, a much less difficult or damaged condition than today. What was the effect of 3.5 years? Till November 1981, when the process was basically completed. When he died, pretty much everybody blew him off. All it took was his death, and they blew him off. So flip it over. Now let's go 35 years later. Look at the world the people are coming out of. It's the Laodicean age. I am not Herbert W. Armstrong. People are coming in an infinitely worse condition. All right. I don't even know if we have 3.5 years. How hard do you think the task is going to be to turn people around? It's going to be a great challenge. But we're all going to have to be tremendously forgiving and understanding. I'm going to have to balance that with absolutely holding standards in the church. And I've explained, those standards will not bend. It will be over my dead body. Mr. Armstrong said, certain things will not change except over my dead body. I actually heard human beings say after he died, I'm going back to certain things because he's now dead. And he said they wouldn't change over his dead body. I heard people say that. Heard women who wanted to wear cosmetics say that. He's now dead. It doesn't apply. I can wear makeup. One woman actually said the word, I can now wear makeup over his dead body. What do you think was stopping her before? His physical presence. But we're going to have a lot of grace built into our skin. We need to be patient. You don't have to turn there, but in James 1 it talks about the importance and the need for patience. Don't turn there. See, it's talking about praying for wisdom, but then you have to have some patience and wait for God to give wisdom. Sometimes life requires patience. Read James 5 about verses 6 through 9. We have to be patient to the coming of the Lord. You have to be patient. Rome wasn't built in a day. You know all of those different things. It is hard to be merciful. I'll show you an astonishing thing in a moment. You're going to hardly believe it. You're going to be shocked that you never noticed it in the scriptures. We're not quite ready for it. Remember in Matthew 18:22. Now you can write these down and look at them later. I'm just going to talk about some accounts. One of the disciples asked Christ, you know, how often should I forgive my brother? Seven times? And he said, I tell you, 70 times seven. And actually, it's 70 times 70, if you really understand the Greek. Now, that doesn't mean there's a limit of 490, for those who do the math. 70 times 70, 4,900. Nor is it 490, 70 times seven, the way it's written in the English. He's saying, you just keep doing it if the brother asks for forgiveness. Now, that's hard. As I recall, it was in that context that, Lord, increase our faith. That's hard to do. Somebody wrongs you. I watched with my wife last weekend, Sunday and Monday, there was this series about the Hatfields and the McCoys and this long feud between Anderson Hatfield, Devil Ants became his nickname, what a name, fit him, and Randall McCoy. And an awful lot of people died because of a feud. Those men eventually declared peace and forgave each other. But McCoy lost half his children in the feud. Hatfield's brother got killed, his little brother, by three McCoy sons in the early 20s. And he rounded up the family, went over and kidnapped these three kids, tied them to a tree and shot them all dead. Well, that Randall McCoy didn't take well to that. And so he killed certain children and relatives and an uncle and brother of Hatfield. Well, Hatfield didn't like that. Nobody could bring themselves to forgive until eventually the law sort of stepped in. Some of them went to prison finally on the Hatfield side, including one of the Hatfield brothers of Devil Ants who was a judge, but he corrupted himself to help oppress the McCoys. It's a fascinating story, and it's come to be a kind of an iconic double name that's used, the Hatfields and the McCoys, to describe people who don't forgive each other. Now, brethren, we can't be the Hatfields and McCoys or anybody else who's unforgiving. You look at Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son. The elder brother who was home and in the field sees that the younger brother, who had gone out and wasted his inheritance with riotous living, with whores, and wound up with pigs, and he had to eat what the pigs ate. And he woke up. It says he came to himself. And he said, I've sinned against my father and against heaven, which a young son would say. He sinned against his human parent, but also his spiritual father in heaven. And he went home, and the elder brother had an attitude about it. We have to be careful. I'm not going to turn there because you know it. Psalm 44, remember, talking about the remnant who's been cast off, and they're in the place of dragons, and they're waiting to come back, and they're crying out for God to save them and deliver them. They've not turned aside to idols or rejected his covenant. They certainly fell into a lot of wrong conduct and landed where they did. And we have to have compassion for them. Another form of mercy is compassion. You can feel for people's needs, and it's part of grace. Let me show you something, this fascinating thing now. Go to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew 9. Most people talk about the feeding of the 5,000, but they never talk about the feeding of the 4,000. We'll come briefly to both of those in a minute, but this sets it up. Matthew 9 and verse 36, Christ was healing all these diseases, preaching the gospel, in every sickness, from village to village. And at a certain point, verse 36, when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them. Christ was God, but he could have certainly looked at them at that moment and said, there but for the grace of God go I. He looked at all of these people of Judah of his time and said, because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. And then, of course, the harvest is plenteous, but the laborers are few, and we're to pray about that. Now, think of that compassion. It's a form of mercy, because you'll see it actually takes that path, that form, here in chapter 14, verse 15. Now, human beings don't learn compassion and mercy very easily, even when they are great servants of God in the making, so to speak. I want to show you something that the apostles missed. You would say this is not possible, but they did. Let's read it. Matthew 14, 15. And when it was evening, the disciples came to him saying, this is a desert place and the time is now past. Send the multitude away that they may go into the village and buy themselves victuals or food. And Jesus said to them, they need not depart. Give them to eat. And they said to him, we have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And he said, bring them here to me. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass and took the 5 loaves and 2 fishes and looked up to heaven and said grace. No, he blessed the food. Okay, why don't people say that? But they don't. God said, say grace, they'd say blessed. Anyway, people, you understand. And broke and gave the loaves to his disciples and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled, and they took up of the fragments that remained 12 full baskets, which is way more than what would have been probably a fraction of one basket before they started. So it was a miracle. It just kept multiplying. Now, people today don't even believe that. That's one of the reasons people don't study their Bible is they're told by their ministers that those are just nice allegories. It's poetry. It's symbolism. It's a metaphor to sort of teach us lessons. But Christ was basically a fictional speaker, and Matthew recorded fictions. The people really believed the God of the Bible was a God of that kind of miracle. Do you think they might read more of what he said? Sure they would. And they that had eaten were about 5,000 men beside women and children. Now, what was the message to the disciples? Well, you decide. Matthew 15 and verse 29. One chapter later, very soon. And then Jesus departed from thence and came nigh unto the Sea of Galilee and went up to the multitude. 15:29, and sat down. And a great multitude came to him, having with them those who were lame, blind, dumb, maimed, and many others, and cast them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. Insomuch that the multitude wondered when they saw the dumb speak, the maimed to behold, lame walk, and the blind see. And they glorified the God of Israel. Miracles will turn people to God, no doubt about that. We'll see that soon enough. Then Jesus called his disciples unto him and said, I have compassion on the multitude. Not just in the Matthew 9 setting, but here, because they continue with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. Now, would we do that? And I will not send them away fasting, lest they faint in the way. Okay, so now we got another big group of people. His disciples said unto him, well, I know what you'll do. You'll just multiply the food. No, they said, when should we have so much bread in the wilderness as to fill so great a multitude? They didn't learn anything about compassion. They just saw it. What? And these guys went on to be apostles. You think there's hope for you to learn compassion? Let's read. Okay. And Jesus said to them, how many loaves have you? And they said, 7 and a few little fishes. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. I mean, the apostles were slow learners, but there was hope for them. And he took the 7 loaves and fishes and gave thanks. Now, that's another way to put it. Still doesn't say said grace. And broke them and gave to the disciples and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat and were filled. And they took up the broken meat that was left 7 baskets full. Should they have been surprised? No. Probably were. And they that did eat were 4,000 men besides women and children. If he could feed 5,000, I'm sure he can handle 4 plus women and children. So maybe it's 10 or 15,000. Or 20,000 the first time and 15 the second. They had big families. And he sent away the multitude and took ship. Compassion. He cared about people. He could feel people's needs. We better be ready for that. A couple more verses. Jeremiah 5. Jeremiah 5. I tell you, mercy is available, but it has qualifiers. Look at what God says. God wants to pardon. He wants to show mercy. Run you to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, Jeremiah 5:1, and see now and know and seek in the broad places. Not just the city of Jerusalem, but Jeremiah lived there. So literally, if you can find a man, there be any that executes judgment and seeks the truth. And I will pardon it. You find anybody in that city that does the right thing. He didn't say, I'll pardon that man. He said, I'll pardon this city. Now that's a God eager to give mercy. The same way God said, I won't destroy Sodom and Gomorrah to Abraham. If you just find 10 people there who are not corrupt. And though they say the Lord lives, you'll believe God's alive. They're not atheists. Surely they swear falsely. They don't believe it. There are a lot of people that say, I believe in God, but God says they're lying. If someone says they believe in God, God's alive, they are swearing falsely to God if they act as though God is not alive. Let's keep reading. O Lord, are not your eyes upon the truth? You've stricken them, but they have not grieved. You've consumed them, but they've refused to receive correction. They've made their faces harder than a rock. They've refused to return. Therefore I said, surely these are poor, they're foolish, for they know not the way of the Lord, nor the judgment of their God. I will get me into the great men and speak to them, for they have known the way of the Lord. They did, and the judgment of their God. But these have altogether broken the yoke and burst the bonds. We don't have to do what God says. Wherefore a lion out of the forest shall slay them, and a wolf in the evenings, and spoil them, and a leopard, and so forth. Well, now, verse 7. How shall I pardon you for this, God says? How am I going to do this? Your children have forsaken me and sworn by them that are not gods. When I fed them to the full, they then committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. That'll go on tonight all over the nations of the Western world because people are fed to the full. Who's God? Get him out of my way. I don't want him sticking his nose in my business. I got adultery on my mind. Tens and scores of millions of people will commit adultery tonight who will probably be in some church tomorrow morning. If you don't know that, then you're not watching the world. They say the Lord lives. They're going to church because they believe that. They're not atheists. But they act as though they don't. God says you're lying. You swear falsely when you say, I swear the Lord lives. It's got to be the way it would be said. They were as fed horses in the morning. Everyone made after his neighbor's wife. Yeah, that's right. 10 out of 11 people have lost their virginity by the time of marriage. You think it gets better after marriage? No. Shall I not visit these things? I'm going to deal with them, says the Lord. And shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Go up on her walls and destroy. But God is willing to forgive if he sees just a little change. That's the God we worship. A God who is so eager to show forgiveness, but he's got to see some change. He's got to see some action. Psalm 25:11, it says, for your name's sake, give me mercy. You might read it. It talks about great sins. And that one we will turn over. For your name's sake, O Lord, pardon my iniquity, for it is great, David recorded. Well, he had some pretty big sins, and all he is going to go on to be in charge of the 12 apostles over the 12 nations of Israel. One of the greatest human beings who ever strapped on a pair of sandals, I'm sure. Nehemiah 9 and verse 17, just quickly, a few last verses. Nehemiah 9 and verse 17. This is the way you ought to see God. Israel refused to obey. 9:17. Neither were mindful of your wonders that you did among them, but hardened their necks, and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage when Israel wanted to go back into Egypt. But you are a God ready to pardon. God is poised, ready to just give mercy as soon as someone seeks it with the right conduct. Gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness. And you forsook them not. You didn't cast aside the nation of Israel. Final verse, Micah chapter 6. Micah chapter 6. Remember, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy, others won't. Mercy is incredibly important to God. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Micah 6:6. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? The Jews are demonstrating in 3 days, 4 days, because they want to open the Temple Mount. They want to rebuild a temple and start the Jewish sacrifices again. That is their goal. They're ready to go as soon as they can get an Israeli government willing to take on the Muslims and potentially create a jihad. And the Jewish government is afraid to do that. But that's what they want to do. They want to start sacrifices again. But the Jews ought to read in the Old Testament, the part of the Bible they claim to adhere to. Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Would God be pleased if I sacrificed my own child to cover my own sin? And those things are not important to God. God has showed you, he has showed you, oh man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? Now stop. That alone ought to make us pause. God has requirements. He has requirements. And here they are. But to do justly. Now that means all of God's law. And to love mercy. Now you have to be willing to receive God's mercy, but you have to love to dispense it as well. And to walk humbly with your God. Actually, the Hebrew is to humble yourself to walk with God. Most people see themselves above God. And the Hebrew is not walk humbly with God. That's a true statement. You walk humbly with God. But the actual Hebrew is lower yourself from your arrogance and come down and walk with God, who you have placed way below you. That's the actual meaning of the Hebrew. And that's a different subject if we were talking about humility. But God requires us to show mercy. We're going to have to begin to do this. We're all in for a fascinating and a wonderful challenge, and we will just see how that plays out. But blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. So if you forget all the other verses, remember that one on a moment's notice, and you'll be just fine.